On today's episode of the On.NET Show, we're going to be learning about what's new with F# from Philip Carter. Check it out. Hi, welcome to another episode of On.NET. Today we're going to learn about what's new in F# from Philip Carter.
Hey.
Hey, how's it going?
Not too bad. Yourself?
Yeah, good, good. I actually used to watch this show back when I was growing up because we're different ages, called Welcome Back, Carter.
Uh-huh.
Do you know that show?
No, okay, I don't. Okay. I'm afraid I'm too young.
Yeah, you should watch that. Okay, so you're the F# language and tools PM?
Yes.
Yeah, so how about we start with some basics? We've got all these languages that Microsoft ships. Mm-hmm. Kind of like, how does F# fit into that? Mm-hmm. And also, why would someone pick F#?
Yeah, totally. So, have it up here on a little website.
Oh, nice, wow.
Handy dandy little site. It's open source cross-platform functional language as opposed to non-functional. So functional programming is, it's not a new thing. It's been around for a long time, but there's a very long time. One could argue, actually, some of the first languages were functional languages.
We just forgot.
Apparently. The Java revolution and then, yeah. But there's plenty that are out there, Scala, Clojure, Haskell, things like that. And .NET has a functional language as well, F#. And F#, it's because it runs on .NET, it also has support for objects and object-oriented programming and things like that. But it does have functional programming constructs such that we kind of think of it as like, we say functional language, but also kind of a functional first language, meaning that when you write code, you want to do so in a functional manner, but you can drop into objects kind of when it's convenient for you, or if you want to interoperate with something, or provide a clean API for C# callers, because C# is like, it has some functional programming constructs, but not really a whole lot. And it's really at its heart an object-oriented programming language. And so that's kind of where it differs, because C# is the one that most people know about for .NET. And that's OO at its heart with some functional sprinkled in. And then F# is functional at its heart with some OO not quite sprinkled in, because it has a rather extensive object system. But for the purposes of your code, you're likely going to have a little sprinkle of object-oriented programming from time to time.
Makes sense. Now, is this true that Scala is to Java as F# is to C#?
That's a pretty good way to think of it. Yeah. Although the family of languages that F# derives from is very different from where Scala derives from. Right. Scala is kind of broken into two categories of developers, I think. I think there's one that just kind of views it as a slightly better Java, or maybe a lot better, kind of depending on their code base. But and they don't really go all that functional with it. They just kind of like the nicer syntax. And then there's people who go full-fledged category theory baked into their types, super functional programming, all that sort of stuff. And Java is like capable of all that sort of stuff. But it's derived from a different family of languages than F# is, right? The F# code, kind of as we have on our little website here, it has kind of like these lets everywhere. There's this thing, pattern matching. The syntax looks a lot different, and the way that you write your code is very different from the way that you would do Scala. But for the purposes of, a functional language running on a runtime, you could definitely think of it that way.
Yeah, now, sometimes I think that you have to be a specific type of person, mm-hmm, to be successful with functional languages. So it's like, oh yeah, people who are a little bit more like academically oriented are the people that go into F#, as opposed to just like regular programmers. Those are the ones who use C#. Is that stereotype reasonable at all, or is that just dead false?
Well, it depends on how you look at it. There are people in the functional programming and F# community who are just brilliant people. They like some people who are literally mathematicians and so on. But you have those in the C# community as well. It's just, maybe they're you don't really hear about them as much. But F# is it is a very utilitarian language. Or if some people in the F# community say I'm kind of lazy and stupid, and that's why I like F#, because I can be lazy and stupid, and the compiler will yell at me when I do it.
Right. It's really approachability now that I think about it, that is really what I'm getting at.
Yeah. So, yeah. Absolutely.
So is it as approachable, would you say?
I would argue that it totally is.
Okay.
I don't think it was in the past. Because there were, depending on the tool set that you got, you may have had to install additional things. It may have been a bit more difficult to figure out where you can get started. But so now we have, you know, this website on the .NET homepage. Well, sorry, a page on the .NET website. I reversed the two. And, you know, there's just a big fat button that says get started with F#.
Yeah.
And what this does is this just takes you to a page where you just download the .NET SDK, and it just shows you, hey, how you can run something from the command line. And the key thing to note here is we don't even really do anything special here with F# because F# is a part of .NET Core. And so if you have .NET Core on your machine, you already have F# on your machine. And I think that's kind of a chasm that had to be crossed, because before you had to say, okay, I got this thing that it can run on, but now I need to go get it so I can run it. Well, how do I go do that?
Yeah.
And then you got to search online. And then that additional step, you just lose so many people who may have been just, you know, casually interested.
Yeah.
And so now that it's just part of it, I think it's far more approachable. And of course, we have tooling in Visual Studio.
I've seen this before.
Yes.
So how about I think we spent like 5 minutes on this topic. Let's find out what's actually new here.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know,
so this is Visual Studio 2017 15.7.
Yeah, so this is preview 5. It'll be out of preview pretty soon. So I imagine by the time people are watching this will be the real full version.
Sweet.
So one thing to note is that I installed, because I have .NET Core and all that stuff on my machine, if I fight with the file new project thing here and then get it, you'll notice that F# is already installed there. And I have some tabs here for .NET Core, .NET Standard, and Web. And then on top of that, I also have this console application and library. We're still trying to figure out how to name that appropriately, kind of like classic F#, if you will, because we still have kind of the older stuff in there. It's just now it's also there with the .NET Core stuff. And so, like, you know, there's some unit test projects there. There's this ASP.NET Core web app thing, which I think is pretty radical. This is the exact same dialogue that you get with C#, just a little less templates because we don't have the Razor stuff in there, because Razor is dependent upon C#. But there's, you know, enable Docker support, and, you know, I can go there and create a brand new project the same way that you would do it in C# if it's installed by default. And I have my Docker Compose stuff in there. I even get the Docker error because I'm not running it on my machine right now. note, if you're going to install Docker support and you don't want to be freaked out by this thing, make sure you have Docker actually running locally.
Yeah, I hear that's useful.
Yeah, but what's great, you know, I can go to this publish tab, and, you know, if you're inclined to publish via the UI, you could do that. You know, you could go to Azure Container Registry. Like, I'm already doing some kind of advanced Azure-y stuff right here, just in a couple of clicks. All with F#. I didn't have to install any additional stuff.
I see. So is what you're showing us now, this is new?
Yeah. This is all new. You're not going to be able to get this in previous versions of Visual Studio.
Okay.
And so, like, if I wanted to publish this web application to a container registry because I wanted that to be the base image for my organization to work on, well, I could do that. And, you know, I'm connected with all the Visual Studio stuff that you would expect from a C# type application.
Or you just wanted to deploy that application to a container service.
Yes. Yeah.
That's the slightly more likely case.
Exactly. And so the reason why that works is because we're on the same, it's called a project system. We're on the same project system as C#. And so you'll notice that there's this thing called microsoft.net.sdk.web specified in the project file. Well, basically, all the tooling in Visual Studio, all it does is it looks for if you are supported in this project model or type, if you will, and you have this attribute, we're just going to light up all this tooling for you.
Yeah.
And so that world was sort of built for multiple languages, and F# is fully supported on all that.
Sweet.
Yeah.
Now, so do you guys have globbing turned off?
Yes,
okay.
We do. And the reason why we do is because in F#, the compilation of the order, the compilation order of the files matters.
Yeah, exactly.
That's because it uses type inference for everything. So
right, so globbing for the folks at home is this basically idea of *.*,
yeah,
to pick up all the files so you don't have to type them. So C# uses that.
Yeah.
Because it's magic.
Yeah, and there's, and except for just one edge case in C# where if you have two, if you have a static constructor and you have two partial classes, then the compilation order matters. That's actually the only edge case where it doesn't. And every other, because then the compiler doesn't know what to initialize first. But
yeah.
In F#, because it uses effectively global type inference to figure out what all the types are. Like, you know, for example, I can hover over this get in a table to identify that, you know, it's taking a, you know, an int, and it produces a string. Well, I didn't specify the fact that it produces a string. The compiler actually figured that out based on how I defined the function. But if you want this to be actually efficient, well, then you need to have your order of files. Because if you specify a different type and you want to have something depend on that type, well, if the compiler has not already seen it, then that algorithm will have to go and look for it, and that could just explode in compile times. And so that's why the ordering mechanism is there. And so
makes sense.
Because of that, we have tools to order your files. So if I wanted to actually cause this project to not compile, I could go ahead and move this up, and then that would change the compilation order. And so if I go here in the fsproj, you'll notice that program.fs is now specified above startup.fs.
Understood.
Now, if I built this, this wouldn't work. But you know, I can just go ahead and move down again. And there's key bindings for that, so you know, you don't have to right-click the whole time.
Yeah, we all love keyboard.
Yeah. But so there's plenty of other new stuff coming along. So I'm going to do something a bit more interesting. So I'll just have a .NET Core console app. I said it was going to be more interesting, but console app's the most boring one of them all. Mm-hmm. Technically, compilers are console apps, so that's kind of cool. But I'm just going to go and manage NuGet packages here. Because there's this really, really cool feature of F-sharp called type providers. And type providers have been recently supported for .NET Core. The tooling for that and like getting all the stuff in the compiler and getting that into Visual Studio is going to be there with 15.7. Some people are kind of already playing around with it, like on Linux machines and so on. But I want to show the experience in Visual Studio because it's really good. So I'm just going to go ahead and install this package. And while we wait for it to download, type providers are a mechanism in the compiler. The type providers are things that the compiler can basically read. And so what happens is this thing ingests a data source, and it builds out an object model. And then the compiler is able to read that object model and then distribute it somewhere. Well, that somewhere is IntelliSense. And so you can effectively get IntelliSense for data, which is really, really great if you want to do some sort of basic exploratory stuff. So I'll just go and head do open fsharp.data. And so let's explore a data source. I was playing around with this, and I'm kind of interested in like city statistics.
Oh, I love city statistics.
Yeah.
Do you know that Toronto is the fifth largest city in North America?
Oh, yeah, and you're totally not saying that because you're Canadian. Right?
Yeah, totally not.
No, I bet Toronto's really cool. I want to visit it. But so what I'm just going to do here is paste in a URL. So this is just the megacity article in Wikipedia. And I'm creating a string literal with this literal attribute. And so this is slightly different than if I removed it. And the reason why I'm going to do this is because I'm going to create a new type. And we'll just call this megacities. And we'll use this thing called the HTML provider. So what this will do is you just pass in a URL to its type argument here. OK, so I've saved that. And you know, if you hover, this is a type representation of an HTML file. So basically, you pass it in a string resource representing HTML, and then you can get an object model for it.
Basically a DOM.
Yeah. Yeah, so I'll go ahead and create a quick function. Let's call it explore or something like that.
So what would have happened if you hadn't put the at symbol there?
Oh, in that case, I think it would actually be fine. I just kind of do that just by habit. Because, I mean, strings are always screwed up, and so.
This one doesn't look too bad.
Actually, I think that would, that would work just fine.
So. Okay.
But yeah, that's usually if you have something like on a file on your machine or something, you're going to have to do that.
Those slashes go the other way.
Yeah.
So that's about the whole escaping nonsense.
Yeah, I usually just like to ignore having to deal with that and just go at just by default. So then we'll go ahead and go let data equal to megacities.getSample. Okay, so this is not like a production code sort of thing that I'm doing right now. You may have noticed in the IntelliSense, there's an async get sample. So that's kind of for when you're loading a resource asynchronously, like actually in your program. But because I'm just going to be doing some like data analysis stuff, I don't care if it's asynchronous. Mm-hmm. And so this data is now this HTML provider of something. So let's
just out of curiosity with these providers, can you just get multiple samples and they're additive such that it gets smarter about the data? Or is each time you call get sample, it's like exclusive and replaces what it knew before?
It replaces what it knew before.
Okay.
So basically, if say this content changed over time, or say I passed in a different URL, then the data that I get is going to be different. So basically, what this get sample call does is actually at design time. So like this literally happened on my machine. It went and it fetched that HTML document, and then it downloaded it, parsed it, uses just a standard HTML provider, and built out an object model that it passed to the compiler. And the reason why I know that is because I just type data dot, and all of a sudden I have this stuff called lists, tables, and HTML. So let's go to tables, because if you remember, there was a little table of stuff there. So I'm just going to go ahead, instead of naming it this discard underscore thing, we'll just call it city tables, right? Let's do something like, let's do this. Let's do city tables dot largest cities.
Oh, please.
So notice in IntelliSense, I get this thing called largest cities that was generated by the compiler, right? Like this is total compile time stuff. This name actually gets erased at runtime, which is kind of cool. And
that's at runtime or compile time?
At runtime. At compile time. That's
yes,
what I meant.
Yes, because that would be super weird otherwise.
Yeah. And then we'll go on the rows. So the rows of the actual cities are. Notice there was also a headers field. So if I wanted to name out what all of the headers were, I could go ahead and do that.
Understood.
And if I were to print this out, you know, then it could print out the actual names. But we actually have an interactive process called F-sharp Interactive that I would be using right now, but we're still. It's really difficult work, and so it's not quite ready to, you know, take this stuff and work every time. But once we have that, then I won't have to like actually just say that you could print it out.
I get it. It'll be a REPL.
Exactly. And that REPL really comes in handy there. Okay, so rows is now an array of row. So if you look at this is what the compiler inferred there. So we'll go array dot, let's go group by, we'll go fun row, and we'll go at row dot. Let's see. Do we want to group by country?
I see. Sure.
Yeah. Let's do that. See, like these are questions.
No. Let's do it by continent because okay. Then we'll be able to test my theory.
Okay. Yeah. But so this is pretty cool. Like you can just be in your editor and start asking these questions. Like, what do we want to group by? Oh, let's just, like, we didn't have to go and read the table data source. Like, I mean, HTML is easy enough, but if this was a CSV, then that might not be so nice.
Oh, totally.
Right, and so there is a CSV provider, for example. So now this is actually going to be a different kind of data that we have here. So if I go fun, we'll go fun, and then this will be a continent, I believe. It'll be a continent and then it's the rows that mapped that particular
yes.
continent. So if we hover over that, continent is a string and rows is an array of rows there.
Which makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we could maybe do something like create a tuple here. So basically what I did here is this is a tuple type. This is, if you're familiar with C-sharp tuples, mm-hmm. this is basically, F-sharp has had them for a while. We'll just have that, and then instead of just rows, we'll do a rows piped into array dot filter by something. Okay. Actually, we don't need to sort it or anything. That could get tricky because the data may not actually have numeric stuff that we could have there. Do we want to do that? Yeah, that could be kind of tricky. Actually, I'm thinking it might just be simpler to just go ahead and take this. Because I'm thinking about how to like transform this data right here. And I can never think and type and talk at the same time.
Yeah.
So instead, we're just going to go ahead and take like the top five or something. And then we'll go array.map. We'll go fun row. And we'll go row.continent and row.population. Then we'll pipe that into array.iter. And then we'll take that, that's a continent, and that's a population. And then we'll go ahead and print that out.
OK.
So we'll go.
This looks pretty straightforward.
Yeah. Let's see what type that is there. That's a string. Okay, cool.
So we're good.
Population is also, it inferred it to be a string rather than an int. I bet the HTML is formatted in a funky way.
Which meant that that sorting would have
That sorting thing would have been kind of onerous.
We would have had to do the analog of
int.parse. It's got this little annotation on there, so we'd have to trim that out. And then, I mean, that's just data cleaning. That's like your typical data science stuff.
Definitely something we don't need for this particular.
We don't want to bore people with that. Okay. Cool. All right. So because I'm lazy and I like it when my code compiles because I don't want to have to think, it's going to compile for me. So let's go ahead and run that.
Let's see.
There we go. Continent. Asia, population. Okay, so that was all the top five. Let's actually take another one here. We'll go row dot mega city. I bet that one's what it's called. I bet that's the actual city there. So notice that I added this thing right here. All of a sudden, now the compiler's yelling at me because I produced a tuple with three elements, and I'm trying to capture a tuple of two elements, but it's saying, hey, these are three things here. Yeah. So we'll call that city there, and we'll go city, do a percent s, because I bet you it's a string as well.
Oh, I see. Yeah. Yes, this makes sense now.
Okay, so we'll run that again. And as I was saying, with F-sharp Interactive, this would be even faster. Okay, so Tokyo, Shanghai, Jakarta, Delhi, and Seoul.
Those are some big cities.
Are the ones, yeah. Unfortunately, Toronto's not in there.
Yeah, well, I never said worldwide.
I wish that were the case. But also, I mean, I kind of didn't really talk about some of the cool stuff that's going on here. Like, first of all, we have this double tick stuff to where you could have like actual like sentences and real words in there, and IntelliSense is able to pick that up. You know, we have, you know, the kind of the semantic highlighting and stuff like that, you know, you get with C sharp. You can click in, you know, the hovers themselves to go to definition, and this will work across projects and stuff. So, you know, if you see some useful information in here, you could actually just navigate to it there rather than have to, you know, then back out and then invoke go to definition there. This is fairly modern tooling. And on top of that, with the 15.7 release, we've done a whole lot of work in performance, especially in memory reductions, because we've been doing a lot of investigative work and reaching out to customers who have like very large solutions. And basically, I'm saying, hey, memory usage is way too high. We basically have to restart Visual Studio sometimes. And then we said, oh, well, geez, that's a real problem. And we've encountered that in our own code base as well. And so we address that with 15.7. And so now
people are going to be happier.
Yeah, memory usage is significantly reduced in this next release. It was we were able to identify some places that were just insane in terms of what they were doing. And with just a little bit of profiling and hard work, it got all better. So and I mean it's still not perfect, right? I mean, this is kind of an ongoing thing. As you know, now we have clearly there's a lot of features in the IDE. You know, things like type providers in .NET Core are all working. Now, kind of, it's all about performance, reliability, responsiveness, that sort of stuff. Because we sort of say, okay, we got all the features. You can use .NET Core basically anywhere. I didn't even show it on the Mac, but you know, you can just do that with it on the CLI if you like.
Even though this is a Mac.
Yeah.
That was too hard.
Yeah. But that's kind of where we're going now. We have this vision of tooling ubiquity and quality for F-sharp for a functional language. So if you go with F-sharp, you get just ubiquity of tooling of an extremely high quality anywhere you want. And so the ubiquity thing is effectively solved now. And so we now want to go with quality and like all the different cool features like type providers being available everywhere. So
awesome.
Yeah.
Well, I think we learned a lot today. Mm-hmm. I'm clearly going to be a F-sharp programmer after this. No, that was awesome. Anything else you want to kind of leave us with in terms of like a call to action or some advice or whatever?
Yeah, I would say step one, you know, if you already have Visual Studio, just, you know, open up your installer. Might take a little while, but...
Hopefully it doesn't need to update.
Yeah, I hope not. But I mean, if you actually already have .NET Core through Visual Studio on your machine, it's all you got to do is file a new project. You don't have to do anything else.
Right.
And you already have F-sharp there. You can start going. If you don't have Visual Studio with .NET Core, you know, you could do that on your Windows machine. and after it's been getting some things ready, there's a variety of workloads.
There are choices.
Yeah. Like, you know, the ASP.NET and web development workload and the Azure development workload, these things have F# because they depend on .NET Core. And then same thing with the .NET Core cross-platform development workload.
Okay. If you so getting into .NET Core was a good plan for you.
Yeah, it wasn't a bad one, I'll put it that way. Also, you know, if you don't use Visual Studio, if you're on a Mac or if you're on Linux or something like that, just go to aka.ms/F#home. That's aka.ms/F#home.
Yeah.
And that'll take you to this site. You know, it's under Annette, Learn Languages, F#. You know, if you don't want to remember that, we just have that little vanity URL. Just click the button that says Get Started with F#.
Definitely.
It's got everything on there. It shows you how to get started. You know, because I'm on a Mac, it shows me instructions there. It tells me to use Visual Studio for Mac, which also has F# support. If I'm on Linux, it'll tell me to use Visual Studio Code and the Ionite F# extension, which is the official F# extension that's maintained by our amazing open source community. And if you're on Windows, you know, it'll tell you to use that. It'll take you to a link to some docs. Like, you know, we have a tour of F#, which is, you know, if you want to learn about some of the major features and kind of what everything looks like, it's there. We have some get started guides in the .NET docs. I think you can actually just search for F# in Google, and this is like one of the first things that comes up.
Must be a great doc.
Yeah. And so, you know, there's the full language reference as well. So if you're curious about specific features, it's all documented there. If you want to learn how to use it on Azure, we have that. And we have, this is also an active area. We're going to be adding a style guide pretty soon to sort of show you, you know, kind of not just formatting styles, but also just sort of general programming idioms in F# so that as you're learning the language, you can feel like you're doing it the right way. Because I do that a lot whenever I learn a new language. I get hindered and I'm like, oh no, but I don't want to continue because I might be doing it wrong.
Yeah.
And we want to solve that as well. So that's kind of another in progress thing that's
been there, done that. Okay, thanks. This was great. Well, thanks for coming by. We'll have to do this again, you know, maybe when we ship 15.9 or 15.10 or something like that.
Yeah.
See where you've got to. Okay.
Absolutely.
Thanks for listening to another episode of the On.NET Show and learning a little more about F#. Thanks.
Bye-bye.